Humans love to build, and we love to make buildings and structures that capture the imagination and seem to defy time. But those structures do fall to the passage of time, to conquest, or to terrorism. So what can their stories tell us? James Crawford tells 21 of those architectural histories in his book, Fallen Glory, The Lives and Deaths of History's Great Buildings. We spoke with him when the book was first published, and we started by talking about the history of a structure from the ancient world, Palmyra in Syria, which had been destroyed by the Islamic State.
It really grew up and reached the sort of an incredible level of opulence over a very short period from about 20 AD up to about 200 AD. And it was built on money and trade because the flow of goods between the Roman and the Sasanian empires moved through this kind of desert oasis. The only way to go between the two was through the city. So they were sort of part of the Roman Empire, but they had a large degree of autonomy at the same time. And basically they taxed the flow of goods and became fabulously wealthy as a result. And I think the Romans viewed them as slightly tacky and a bit nouveau riche in terms of how they developed.
You know, it's interesting, though, because this crossroads of history nature that Palmyra embodies is one of the things, one of the reasons why Islamic State fighters proceeded to destroy, or they say destroy, you know, much of the ancient ruins. I mean, in the words of those fighters, they say the ruins were created by, quote, devil worshippers. I mean, so it's like it's very, the city's own history comes back to haunt it.
It does. I mean, I think Islamic State are sort of apply an incredibly crude understanding of history, perhaps deliberately, because they don't really care. I mean, right. One of the reasons I think they attacked Palmyra so vociferously is because the Western press were so appalled, and us being appalled helped their cause. So they continued to kind of demolish the buildings systematically. And then, you know, they're a very kind of propaganda savvy organization, if you like. I wouldn't even give them the benefit of calling them a state. And they were using that. The reason they were using it is because we have such emotive connections to buildings. And in many ways, that's what my book is about, is that sense that, you know, we sort of shout with joy when we raise buildings up and we weep with sorrow when we destroy them. And we do continue to destroy them all over the world all the time. And the lives and particularly deaths of buildings have an enormous impact on global politics today still.
Well, let's move forward to another grand piece of architecture that you write about, whose destruction was actually celebrated rather than mourned. And this is the Berlin Wall, which went up in 1961 pretty much overnight. Now, you call it the Mirror Wall. Why is that?
I kind of call it that because, to me, the Berlin Wall was always this sort of dark fairy tale that I was aware of. And it was this sense that you had a city of opposites divided in two. And on one side, on the west side, the wall was there to keep people in. And on the east side, they perceived it as being there to keep people out, to keep this sort of aggressive, militaristic West out. So there's a sense that when each side looked at the wall, they saw themselves reflected back rather than understanding what was going on. And of course, this divided a city, but it also divided the world. You know, it was very much the split between capitalism and communism, between East and West. It was the epicenter of the Cold War. It was such an emotive and powerful symbol. And of course, walls are very much in vogue again right now. So it's a very interesting one for us to talk about today.
Well, in fact, if I can just jump in here, that's exactly what I wanted to ask you. Because in your book, you write that, you know, in the 1980s, of course, people remember that Ronald Reagan famously said, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." Mm. You write that the very idea of a wall that could, quote, act as a serious barrier between people had become an almost comic anachronism. But as you point out, the pendulum has swung very strongly in the other direction, and walls are seen as something that's desirable to separate people again.
I mean, I think there still is an element that it's a comic anachronism, and satirists are getting a lot of joy out of the very concept of the wall between the U.S. and Mexico. But I think the interesting thing about it is the wall was only brought down after there was a realization that it was a nonsense. You know, it was a kind of diplomatic error that led to the people in the East believing that the checkpoints had been opened and that the border was clear for access and for passing through. So it was a psychological barrier. I mean, initially it wasn't even a wall. It was actually rolls and rolls of barbed wire. And over time, it gradually became a wall. But it was always perceived as a wall because on that night in November 1989, when the wall fell, it didn't fall. But people came together, they stood on top of it, they danced, they kissed, they hugged, and suddenly it was gone. And then it was over the sort of subsequent period that it was systematically torn down. But at the time that it was actually being torn down, a lot of people in East and West Berlin suddenly faced with this absence. They had one in three West Berliners and one in four East Berliners saying they actually wanted the wall back because it played such an enormous part of their lives. So while as a physical structure, it's kind of a nonsense, it exists as an ideological, a political, and a psychological structure.
I feel like this is actually the perfect segue to one of the last chapters that I want to talk with you about, because you dedicate a chapter to a city or a structure that doesn't actually exist in the physical world. It was purely digital. And that is GeoCities, which I imagine there are a lot of listeners right now who are hearing this and saying, what? Because they're too young to even remember what it was. But can you remind us, what was GeoCities?
Yeah, GeoCities was effectively the very first internet city, and I suspect also the very last internet city. It was developed in the mid-1990s. Its kind of creators wanted to try and give people a way of navigating and understanding the internet in its formative years. And they thought the best way to do that was to give people addresses. And they placed those addresses within the sort of structural concept of a city. So you lived in a district or a suburb that was related to your interests. So that might be sport, it might be fashion, it might be history, it might be music, it might be politics. So you had this address and you had, at the time, 2 megabytes of space is effectively what you bought. And you were an internet homesteader. And it became, within 2 years, it went from no citizens to 1 million citizens. It was the fastest growing city in human history. And there was an attempt to monetize it. It was bought by Yahoo, and Yahoo failed to monetize it and ultimately switched it off. But in switching it off, they perpetrated one of the greatest acts of cultural destruction, if you like, that's ever occurred. Because people had put all their data up there, it wasn't backed up, and it was wiped out in an instant.
Huh. Do you really think that that destruction carried the same lasting impact as, the destruction of other things we've been talking about, like the Berlin Wall or Palmyra? Because as we're underscoring, GeoCities existed entirely on the internet.
I think there was a lot of creative material were put up on that. This was the development of personal web pages, almost like your Facebook profile page. So people were putting photographs up there, they were putting poems up there, it's early blogging. All this material, which historians maybe hundreds of years down the line would be able to use to understand individual voices, is gone.
Right.
And there's very much this kind of danger, and people talk about this concept of a digital dark age, that because a lot of what we do now exists in this kind of digital plane, it can very easily be erased. And even though these things don't have physical presence, they have an enormous emotive presence. And in a way, this is the kind of next frontier for structures and for development. And it may be where we suffer some of the greatest losses in the future without even realizing it.
So this is one of the great takeaways that I glean from your book. And that is that buildings seem to be humankind's attempt to convince ourselves that things can be permanent in an impermanent world, because every building that we've talked about had its own lifespan and came to an end.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, the very first sort of story of architecture, one of the very first stories ever written down, the Epic of Gilgamesh, is about an attempt by a mortal man to achieve immortality. And he goes on a quest to find the gods and to find the sort of the secret of immortality. And he's basically told that you're a mortal man and you will never get this. And as he returns to his city and he walks through the gate and the great walls of the city he's created, he realizes that architecture is his best shot at it. Architecture is the best way to achieve life beyond your own life. So I think that's been there from the very, very start, this understanding of legacy through what we create and through what we build.
Well, James Crawford is author of Fallen Glory, The Lives and Deaths of History's Greatest Buildings. Thank you so very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And we spoke with James Crawford last March.